Living in America used to be a dream. For so many people far away and unseen, with their big cars and movie stars, living in America, all hail to the red, white, and blue. Living in America was a dream. In this land they tell you to reach for anything you want, and everything is possible, just believe that you can. Cause we're God's chosen children, living in America with that long house and my picket fences, living in America.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back. This is Richard Sachs on Lost Arts Radio. Nice to see you again. And it's exciting that we get episode two today of our session with Joel Skouse in our series on the history of the deep state. And it's not just history, because it's going to culminate in a lot of current events that we'll understand better in that context. And that's the whole real purpose of it. As the deep state is another one of those phrases that's used a lot, and almost never defined, except very vaguely, and giving not just a verbal description, but a historical context is going to make everything a lot more meaningful in the present and easier to predict what's likely to happen and what our real options are. So, Joel, if it's okay with you, my idea of what we could do this time is, well, first of all, I do want people to go back and watch episode one so that you'll understand what we talk about today more, so we don't have to recap everything. And you should see that on the October 27th broadcast, and that'll bring you up to date. But just for the people who are not real sure of what we've done so far, Joel, I thought we'd take maybe a minute or two and recap. We were mentioning things about World War One and World War Two, and some of the big events there that led up to where we're going to talk about today. And I'm imagining that we'll go back and weave in things, not in a strictly sequential timeline, but kind of filling in pixels in the picture from whatever time comes up that makes sense, if that's okay.
Yes, yes. In the first episode, we talked about how the globalists, and first of all, let's go back to a definition of the deep state. The deep state is not, as Sean Hannity and other conspiracy deniers claim, is a bunch of Obama holdovers in the administration that are thwarting President Trump. While they are that, it's a much deeper conspiracy. It's a very lethal conspiracy. The deep state controls a dark side of every federal agency, from the DEA to the CIA to the FBI, and it has to control, therefore, all of the top managers and heads of those agencies, so that Pompeo, when he said, you know, the CIA, we lie, cheat, and steal, he knew. And, to claim that that's somehow legal and proper because we're the CIA is a real problem. But it is illegal, in fact, in federal law, for the agencies to use national security and security clearances to cover up for illegal acts. It's plain right there in the law. But because the deep state controls judges as well, all of the major appeals court judges and all of the Supreme Court, even those that are conservative because they have dirt on them, it's like, John Roberts, he was playing the conservative role until he got the phone call of the night, you got to vote for Obamacare. And so he switched his vote and called it a tax to justify it. But that's how the deep state operates. They use conservatives, let them be conservative until they need them, because they don't want to make it obvious to people that they control everything. But in essence, they do. You know, people keep asking me, when is the deep state, really going to be a threat to us? I said, well, it's already in control of the government. Right. And, what you're seeing in Donald Trump is just the what's on the surface, but it's down there working to destroy him every day of the week. And he, unfortunately, because he doesn't understand the deep state, doesn't know who's deep state and who isn't, he ends up going along with so many of the things because of lack of experience and lack of understanding. Though his instincts are proper, right. He seems to sense that it's not right to be in these foreign wars, but he gets into a mess. Now, the wars are very important because the globalist conspiracy deals a lot with creating a crisis and then proposing a solution to that, which you would not normally accept without that crisis. And that's why they believe in world wars to alter the geopolitical landscape. And as we pointed out in the first episode, they did World War One for two basic reasons. One, you had to get rid of two monarchies which were not going along with globalist control financially. And that was the Tsar of Russia and the Kaiser of Germany. And they, of course, killed the Archduke Ferdinand. That was just a trigger for it. And they always need a trigger or some type of false flag that they blame on the Serbs so that they can go to war. But it was clearly over getting rid of Germany and the Tsar. And that's why during the middle of World War, or toward the end of World War One, they financed the revolution in Russia. Both the British and the Americans gave $20 million in gold to the Bolsheviks to finance that revolution. And then when the white Russian army fought against the Reds, the United States cut off and Britain cut off military aid to the white Russians so that the Reds could lose. Now, in the aftermath of World War One,
let's clarify, Joel, and I really hate to interrupt, but I just want to make things clear without losing the train of thought. Given the climate that we're in right now, why don't you clarify what you mean by white Russians?
Well, the white Russians were the Russian army that was patriotic to the Tsar and to the existing conservative. They were anti-communists. So the anti-communists, and they were in the majority to start out with in that war, and they were winning until the U.S. cut off and Britain cut off their supplies of ammunition.
Okay, not a racial term.
That's correct. That's correct.
Good.
Now, the purpose of World War One was also, from a globalist point of view, to get us into a world government. And that's why the puppet president in the United States, Woodrow Wilson, becomes such an ardent supporter of the League of Nations. But fortunately for William Howard Taft and others, which they label as isolationists, they were actually patriots who believed in U.S. sovereignty, they killed that. They would not allow that to be ratified by the Senate. So Plan B was instituted. Even during the negotiations, because they knew that there was a chance that the League of Nations would not fly in the United States, they set up the Treaty of Versailles and the reparations on Germany to be so onerous that they knew that Germany would have to go to war in order to get rid of those reparations someday. And in addition...
That was 1915, 1916, something like that?
1918 is when the Treaty of Versailles, the revolution in Russia was 1917, just as World War One was ending.
So Wilson was really used to do some bad stuff because he had just finished arranging the Federal Reserve and the income tax and things like that. Right?
And we have to remember in the election to get Wilson elected against Taft, they ran Teddy Roosevelt as a third party candidate in the Bull Moose Party, in order to siphon off the votes from Taft in order to have Wilson elected. And they controlled Wilson because he had an affair at Stanford, and they knew that he'd been immoral, and so they had that over him. So you have all the principles of managing a global New World Order. You have a globalist one-world government objective. You have the overthrow of resistance movements from monarchies and conservative governments. You have the overthrow of political movements that are resistant to the New World Order. And then in 1913, you got the income tax and all of those horrible things to finance the eternal wars. And of course, it was, and Social Security, it was promised to be, just a 1% tax. And of course, it has risen ever since then. They got their foot in the door.
Real short term also. It was not going to last very long.
Yeah. But in any case, leading up to World War, there was another motive that surfaced from the globalists in World War II. And because of the reparations, prior to World War II, the Germans had a gold-backed mark, and which limited their ability to inflate. Because if they inflated too much, people would start to trade, or nations would start to trade their money in for gold. And that's what France did. Globalist advisors from Wall Street came over to the Weimar Republic to help corrupt it. And they advised them to get out from under these onerous reparations that they start to print fiat money that was no longer gold-backed. And this will precipitate a lot of what happens in World War II, because France then invaded the Ruhr district of Germany, where all the steel and coal was, and started to confiscate all of the production of German steel and coal industry and take it back to France, and didn't pay for it, and thus the workers were not being paid. And so the German government was talked into then paying the salaries of all the workers in the Ruhr district, which had become part of France. They'd actually taken the territory away from Germany as part of the reparations. And because of that, inflation started to rise. First, the fiat currency going off the gold-backed standard, and then to pay the wages. And all the rest of the workers in Germany started to complain because prices were going up, their wages weren't going up. But all the major labor unions, et cetera, in the Ruhr district were getting paid higher and higher wages. And so the government allowed everyone to start to raise their wages according to the rate of inflation. Now, that's how you get hyperinflation, by the way. You cannot have hyperinflation just by printing more money, because most people can't raise their wages. So if you print more money and the price rises, they can't buy anymore. They stop buying less and less. And that's called stagflation. That's what we had in 1976 when Nixon had price controls and he was trying to tamp down inflation. Remember in 71, the U.S. went off the gold standard because France and other nations were demanding U.S. gold as trading in for the currency because of the high rate of inflation. And so you get stagflation without indexing. Indexing is where the government, you know, has everyone raise their prices. And sometimes it doesn't even take an edict of government. If everybody gets accustomed to raising the prices according to inflation, then it turns into a very, very fast spiral. It's happened in Argentina. It's happened in Zimbabwe in modern times. Argentina, you know, inflation has been anywhere from 45 to 400%. And that's why in the Argentine banking crisis, when inflation reached a peak in the year 2000, over $50 billion paper U.S. dollars came out of the mattresses or wherever people in Argentina stored that money into the economy, because nobody could use credit cards. The banks wouldn't accept anything. And so they brought the cash out. That was one of the ways in which the government was able to clean out the underground dollar economy in Argentina. It's also one of the reasons why the U.S. has never repudiated any of the dollars, even older $100 bills. They're still good, because they know that the reason that the U.S. can inflate so much and not show up as inflation at home is because there's this vast sea of dollars spread throughout all the world. If there were $50 billion in the mattresses of Argentina, think how much there is in Iraq, where they brought in pallets full of $100 bills during the Iraq war to pay off the Sunnis and the Shia warlords. And in Afghanistan, they did the same thing. In Russia, they sent in pallets full of $100 bills. That's why the Russian oligarchs only had $100 bills when they went to Europe to spend. They didn't have any change.
What about the old 500 and 1,000 and higher bills like that?
Well, they, of course, got rid of those. You can no longer circulate those. Those are not considered legal tender.
Okay.
If you have any of those, you have to go to a bank and get them, you know, reprocessed. But they long ago wanted to get rid of the large denomination bills because they knew that they would engage in drug trafficking eventually, and they wanted to be able to make sure that everything in drug trafficking took loads of cash so they could, you know, prosecute who they wanted to, but of course, you know, cover up for who they wanted to as well. And so this was really one of the triggers of the Weimar inflation, was the German or the French invasion of the Ruhr district in Germany. And this also, as I said, brought in another purpose of globalism, that is to foment socialism. In other words, they were the ones that advised them to inflate the currency, knowing that that hardship on people would demand socialist policies. And that's why communism rose identical with socialism in Germany. And so Hitler rose, because communism is a more virulent form of socialism, with radical power and police state tactics, as well as just redistribution schemes. Mm-hmm. Hitler was able to rise to power as a savior in the threat against communism. That was one of the main reasons why he was able to gain power over the existing monarchy there, because who had to abdicate in favor of his election as chancellor, because he promised to overthrow the Russians.
And he took over an existing party to do that, right? A really small one that wasn't doing much.
Yes.
And it had the name Socialist. And people still think, because, you know, social sounds good. And I don't think many people understand what socialism even is these days.
Well, there's two or three levels of socialism, and it's a very important concept. One is where you own all of the means of production and there's zero private property and everything is controlled by the state. That's the Soviet view, and it's an abject wreck. All right. The other form is the more moderate form of socialism, where the state owns most of the major forms of production, but they allow some manufacturing to be in private hands. And that also doesn't work very well. The trains don't run. It happened in Italy. It happened in France. It happened in Great Britain before Margaret Thatcher. The trains don't run on time and everything is a wreck and everything's running down. The telephones were ancient in Britain, for example, during their socialist period. And so Margaret Thatcher was able to get that privatized and things really boomed for a while. But once people get infected with what I call benefit corruption, that is, they're corrupted by the draw of benefits, it's very difficult to overcome that. They want, and any time the free market doesn't, you see, socialism offers universal high benefits to everyone regardless of true worth. In the free market, low true worth people don't get very many benefits. They are the poor, and for good reason, because they have low true worth, low intelligence, low work ethic, corruption, crime, etc. They don't get in the free market. And socialism promises everybody a minimum true worth, which is very attractive in the bell-shaped curve, because the majority in that bell-shaped curve is attracted to socialism. The high end of the bell-shaped curve, the entrepreneur class, are getting penalized because they're having to pay for this. And of course, your criminal class gets the same benefit as the bell-shaped curve. So the majority of people are attracted to socialism because you get something for nothing, or at least more rewards than what the free market would offer. Right. And that's why socialism is so hostile to judgment. You judge me. You know, how dare you judge me? Well, judgment is good, because that's how the free market penalizes lazy people. And penalizing error and crime is judgment. Right. Not just official judgment, but private judgment. That's why socialists want to act. But then there's a third type of socialism, which is Fabian socialism, where you own everything, or they tell you you own it, but we regulate it. And that's what we're living in the United States. And there's a certain amount of redistribution of wealth in that Fabian socialism. But essentially, it's so seductive because they tell everybody, no, you're still free. You still own property.
Yeah.
But you're just regulated to death.
That's why it's the People's Republic and names like that, right?
That's
because
right.
Everything belongs to the people. You see that currently, and I know we're not really ready to fully get into current events in this session, but universal basic income is being proposed by major presidential candidates, along yes. with minimum wages that are as high as you need for everybody to be really well off. It's
That's right.
related to exactly what you're talking about.
And of course, what they don't tell you is that minimum wages, by raising the wage, they make certain people unemployable because they're not worth a minimum wage. And so, you know, this talk about a living wage is a very important concept. Most people don't need a living wage. Now, a single male family man does need a living wage, but so many young people live with their family, they live with other people, they don't need a full wage in order to survive, and they wouldn't even get a start in the market if there weren't cheap labor offerings. And that's what they don't tell you in terms of minimum wage, how it destroys labor at the lower end.
Yeah, and you're not just talking about a high minimum wage, you're talking about any minimum wage. And this has been misconstrued to show that people who think like that have no compassion, and they think that everybody should just starve to death unless they're rich.
Yeah.
Right.
But they don't. Most people who live at a subpar wage live just fine because they're living with parents, they're living with friends, they're sharing in some communal relationship. A lot of people, as they're transitioning through, I did that myself.
Yeah.
Now I'm independently a middle class, upper middle class person, but I started out living at home and working, flipping hamburgers and other types of things. Right. My brother Neil delivered newspapers till he was 18 years old and made quite a bit of money at it. But
yeah. I remember friends in junior high that had paper routes like that. It would be considered a non-living wage, and they loved it. because it was all spending money for them. They had no expenses.
That's right. Yeah. So going back to World War II, the globalist objective was to create an atmosphere where the free market in Germany could be blamed for all the hardship. When prices rise, and it isn't mandated by government, they figure, hey, this is greedy capitalism raising the prices. So we demand a living wage. We demand socialism. And that's where, and in with the combination of communism saying we're the socialist, you know, thing that you ought to choose, and not, and Hitler coming up and said, no, the communists are very dangerous. And they were. And that's how he got a tremendous amount of support. Right. Plus the fact that he did use some communist tactics, his brown shirts, you know, which were a violent group that destroyed other people. And then there's the Reichstag fire. The German parliament, called the Reichstag, was burned. They had hired a communist to do it, and then they blamed it on the communists when it was actually the Hitler people that had hired the communists to start the fire in the Reichstag. But that was the typical one of your first major false flag events in this era that was important. Now, false flags would continue as German military might continued to build, and the British started, you know, there was a pacifist group within the in the British. There was a pro-German group within the Chamberlain group. And, of course, the globalists had a handle on Churchill. They were going to make this war, and Churchill was going to be their man. And Churchill is lauded as the great, you know, savior of Britain, but Churchill was actually a globalist. He was a sexual pervert. He had many, many problems, financial and otherwise, but he was given immunity and paid. He was a disaster as the first admiralty, chief of the admiralty in Britain, and the Battle of Gallipoli was directly, you know, his fault. But he continued to be put back into government because those of the elite at Cambridge and others, you know, were getting inside the British government, knew that he was their man. And they always use people who are sexually perverted because it allows for blackmail. It allows for them to control them.
Exactly. Well, sexually perverted specifically in a way that society condemns for that reason.
That's right. Or used to anyway. And now it's getting to be so that they're building up people's tolerance. And, you know, that's why they've gone to pedophilia as well as gay. It used to be homosexuality was the thing. Now it's gone to pedophilia because nobody in civil society can ever accept pedophilia, whereas they're being taught to accept homosexuality. Right. So pedophilia is now the new horror. And that's why Jeffrey Epstein and all of that was involved in pedophilia, so that they can really put a clamp on the politicians. And it's almost required. You're going to be a globalist. You've got to have sex with underage people.
Let me interject one thing, and that's that you said some things to help define deep state, but people are also very vague or confused about the meaning of the word globalist, and we're using that word.
Okay. Well, a globalist, in the truest sense of the word, is one who is part of a very large satanic conspiracy to take away all national liberty and all individual liberty and put it under a mega powerful government called a globalist government, a new world order, if you will. That said, about 80% of people who are globalists are not aware of that conspiracy or that conspiracy's use of wars to do that. They are just soft, illiberal individuals who have been pro-socialist individuals, because globalism is a Fabian socialist system. They believe in private ownership, free markets, but controlled free markets and regulation and control by the globalists. That's why in the EU, they have this in the EU constitution, you're free, you have freedom to choose, you have freedom to private. But when society needs, you know, we can intervene in that. You know, there's that fine print in the EU constitution, which nullifies any of those individual rights. But that's a very important one. Now, so it's very important to understand that because a person is a globalist, it's very difficult to tell on the outside whether or not they are a knowing conspirator with the conspiracy of globalism or whether or not they've just bought into this. And it's easy to buy into, even not just ideological, because, you know, you don't get to be a general officer in the U.S. military unless you go through, unless you are a globalist or at least open to that. You go to the National War College, you're taught by Georgetown professors who are all globalists, and they talk about the glories of the United Nations and in international, and anyone who objects doesn't make rank.
So in other words, globalism is one all-powerful government that gets to decide everything for the world.
In the West.
Well, isn't it all countries?
No, it isn't. There are three power centers in the world, and each of them, I believe, are run by satanic revelation. There is the Anglo-American globalist, which we deal with, which is the favored son of Satan, in my opinion. And then there is the satanic control of the communist conspiracy in China and the communist conspiracy in the Soviet Union, which faked its own demise in 1990, faked its own demise so as to get Western aid and trade, but the party still runs the government. Even though Putin has become a new strongman, he, and we'll get into that later, he basically overthrew the original communist oligarchs and created his own now, and so he's like a new Stalin. And Xi Jinping is like the new Mao, and more urbane, more well-spoken than Mao or Stalin, but clearly they are powerful men that control the Communist Party in both of them. So there are three separate conspiracies all trying to gain control of the New World Order. And Hitler was part of a satanic conspiracy. He was very deep into the occult. You know, that's very well, some of the best histories on World War II, for example, by David Irving. He's unjustly been given the accolade of a Holocaust denier, which is not true. He documented how many things in the Holocaust were done that were exaggerated, like the gas chambers, and or falsified. But he was not a Holocaust denier. He simply challenged the degree to which it was. And he was of the viewpoint, which I think is correct, that the globalists, because there is a high percentage of Jewish, unprincipled Jewish people in the globalist conspiracy, they created a class, a protected class of individuals, Jews in general, that could not be criticized, lest you be an anti-Semite. And so that's the reason for so much of the Israeli lobby and all of this that comes out and attacks anyone critical of Israel or anyone critical of Jews, because they want to provide a protected class because there are so many Jews in globalism now. I don't talk about Zionism per se. I talk about the threat of globalism because all the bad Jews are in globalism. Okay? And there is a religious Zionism, which is not conspiratorial, and there's a leftist Marxist form of Zionism that created the State of Israel, which is conspiratorial. But because of the taint of anti-Semitism and all that, I choose to attack the globalists because that includes all the evil Jews that are part of the globalist conspiracy, like George Soros and Henry Kissinger and people like that.
So it is people who believe in a one-world government for that one out of three sectors that you mentioned.
That's right. Or those that are promoters of it, but not aware of the actual conspiratorial thing. Okay. And so when I say globalist, it could be either or. There's a whole bunch of globalists in the world who are, and whether they're Susan Rice at the United Nations or Nikki Haley, who's not part of the conspiracy, but who is so anxious to please and win political power for herself someday that she goes along with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of people in Washington that know there's a power structure. They don't know who's running it, but they've seen people killed, they've seen people silenced, and so they know you don't buck it, you don't ask any questions.
And as far as understanding of globalism, even the U.S. president right now, at least recently, showed he really didn't understand what it was. He gave a speech and he said, well, it's what's good for the whole world compared to what's good for the country. It's nothing like that.
Right? No. Trump simply came from a background of knowing nothing. He was spoon-fed everything as a CEO financially.
Right.
And he wasn't that good of a financial CEO. He had to declare bankruptcy to save his career several times. He's been immoral. That means he's got a corrupted conscience. He doesn't listen to conscience very well. That's why he doesn't get good inspiration. Occasionally it gets through. His instincts will say, like, nah, we better not attack Iran, or we better pull out of Syria. But, you know, that's a complex case we'll talk about later.
Yeah.
Let's go back to war here. It's very important that the globalists are satanic inspired. And at the very top, I believe there's actual revelation. And the proof of that is, is that no mafioso type corrupt criminal individual could ever set this process in motion and have his plans carried forth even past two generations. The mafia proves that. You can't designate an heir apparent and have it last for more than one or two generations. It just self-destructs and somebody else takes over. Right. And it goes in a different corrupt direction. But the globalist conspiracy has gone on nonstop ever since 1776. And, you know, they haven't had a great deal of control in government. They had a lot of manipulation. They started out using the Masonic system, and then that got exposed, and they switched to... Now there was over 300 globalist organizations to make it very difficult to track what's going on. You can't point to anything like the Bilderberg Group or the Aspen Institute or the Royal Institute of International Affairs of Britain and say that's where it's happening. Now, we do know that in the core city of London, that the globalists do in the British Isles meet there, and they do plan, because we've had a couple of whistleblowers come out of that meeting and to reveal what they were planning. But New York, because of the U.S. power base now, New York and Washington, D.C. is really where the big power center of the globalists is now. But still, there's a power center that meets in the city of London, the smaller financial district of London that they control. Now, going back to World War II, when World War II started through the appeasement of Neville Chamberlain, peace in our time, of course, and Hitler invaded Poland and Czechoslovakia. The U.S. or the Britain declared war against Germany, and thus set Germany said, okay, you've declared war, we're free to launch out against Europe. So they launched out against Belgium and France and won that. Now, from that point on, it's very interesting that Hitler is portrayed as the person who now is bombing London out of oblivion. But as David Irving points out in his book, Churchill's War, a very important concept, Hitler did not want to attack Britain. He wanted to make a deal with Britain. He wanted to rule the world with Britain. He respected Britain's empire, and Germany had other empire countries in Africa, etc., Namibia and others, which were German colonies. So they wanted to join forces with them. And Churchill, as a globalist, could not get Hitler to bomb London. And he needed Hitler to bomb London in order to whip up public fervor against the Germans, etc.
Right.
And so what David Irving points out is that Churchill firebombed the Ruhr district after the Germans took back the Ruhr from France and invaded half of France, etc. Churchill firebombed cities in the Ruhr, firebombed, killed all the civilians in order to provoke Hitler into attacking London. Prior to that time, Hitler had only attacked military bases. He never attacked London City until after Churchill provoked him by firebombing cities in the German Ruhr. Now, that's an important thing to know.
That's really, really an example of a strategy that's been used over and over again, right, by leaders that people thought were really good people.
That's right. And, of course, you know, Churchill has been lauded. You can't criticize Churchill. He's just considered apple pie and motherhood and all of that in terms of, but he was really a pretty squirrely individual. He was a great orator. He was a fantastic orator and could really get, but he was a hypocrite in many, many respects. Now, throughout the prosecution of the war, there were the other additional firebombings of the German cities. Dresden, they used white phosphorus incendiary bombs to burn the city. And there are stories of U.S. pilots who, because they had blacked out the industrial sector so that they wouldn't be able to see their targets, but the residential sectors were still all lit up with streetlights. And when they were ordered in to drop these incendiary bombs on the residential, the pilots protested. Those are residential areas, and they were told, you're going to bomb them anyway.
Wow.
And so there was a deliberate attempt. These are war crimes committed by the Western Allies. Churchill, and Eisenhower was involved and knew about those things. And these are war crimes to do that. At the end of the war, several other tragedies occurred. As you know, at the Yalta talks, there were talks in Tehran, there were talks in Cairo, there were talks in Yalta. The greatest giveaway was given at Yalta, where, of course, Roosevelt, at the behest of communist or globalist Alger Hiss, it's my opinion that Alger Hiss was actually a globalist who joined the Communist Party so that they wouldn't think twice about him bringing in communists into the Roosevelt administration. Mm. But he was too urbane and debonair to be a communist. He was a globalist, in my opinion. So he talked Roosevelt into, of course, giving Stalin the right to repatriate by force all of the post-Soviet bloc people who had escaped to the West during the war, want them all sent back to the Soviet Union. This included an entire army of Cossacks from Ukraine who had fought for Germany against Russia because they were anti-communist, and they were taken after the war into a British prisoner of war camp, and then told that they were going to go on R&R, and they were put and loaded into trucks, and they were driven into Russia and handed over to Stalin. Wow. So that was a great evil, is the betrayal of that entire anti-communist Cossack army, which was willing to join the West and give them back to Stalin. In addition, the United States knew that Stalin had kept back about 6,000 to 8,000 American and British prisoners of war, military people that had been, the Russians had liberated from the German prison camps and kept them in Russia as hostages to make sure that Roosevelt followed through with Operation Keel Haul. Even after Operation Keel Haul was followed through, and by force, all of these Russians and Ukrainians and Croatians and everybody in Eastern Europe were driven back into the gulags of Stalin. He never released the prisoners back to the U.S. He continued to use them as hostages to keep people like Patton, who wanted to go to war against the Soviet Union and do those things, to keep them at bay. And the U.S. government never told the American people about the what amounts to almost 20,000 U.S. and British soldiers that they left to rot in the Soviet gulags. Now, that's a great war crime.
Right.
In addition, General Eisenhower starved about 2 million German soldiers who had done their best to get to surrender into American arms for feeling that they were going to get better treatment from Americans, of course, than from the Russians, which they would. And he purposely gave them no winter clothing, no tents in the wintertime, and cut their rations in half so that most of them, 2 million German soldiers, starved. And they went to their deaths hating Americans for what they did to them.
That was Eisenhower?
Eisenhower.
So the reality is that both sides in the war, both upper management systems in the war, were equally insane. Or at
not,
least
not insane, evil, evil.
Both that's of them were, sorry, not insane. Just different styles. I know that, at least from his writings, Hitler was completely insane in the sense that he was an incredible, intense racist and believed that the German people were the ones that should inherit the whole globe. But the evil was less overt in the other side, the Allies, I guess.
And more covered up, more carefully covered up. Remember, Scheer in his book, The Rise of the Third Reich, has been clear about demonizing Hitler for everything that he did.
Right.
But Hitler became unstable only really toward the end. I mean, his megalomania was really, a lot of it involved in satanic seances with evil spirits and things, which... And he, you know, his judgment for being a corporal was absolutely brilliant. And that had to be because of satanic inspiration. But at some point, God intervenes and stops Satan from helping him out, and he starts to falter. And he made tremendous decisions, bad decisions, at the very end, as he lost that satanic help, which was helping at the beginning of the war.
Those two sides of unseen help are playing huge roles in all kinds of history, including, of course, present day, and not just with military applications, but in Hollywood and all kinds of different situations. It's not a belief system. It's actually real, which is pretty amazing.
That's right. And it's important to understand that the evil that goes on in the world is really, let me put it this way, it's tolerated by God for testing purposes. In other words, there have to be consequences for the evils of immorality and homosexuality and pedophilia and all of the higher divorce rate and the pornography and the other things that violate one's conscience and what God warns people that are not good for you. And so to a certain extent, he has to allow a great deal of leeway to evil so that consequences come upon people. And that was, even though life was better in the 30s and 40s, people were more moral, they had more. World War II did a lot to corrupt people and corrupt soldiers. Homosexuality wasn't that big of a problem in World War II, but prostitution was. They prostituted all of Europe with American soldiers, and American military leaders responsible for not clamping down on that. And the Russians were even worse, of course. The rape of Germany was just a classic case of the soldiers completely gone wild. I mean, girls, children, women, grandmothers raped multiple times, sometimes killed. It was just a real tragedy. And the U.S. did not put pressure on Russia to stop it. And it was just really sad. Yeah. So that's why the Lord allows Satan to have so much power, in my opinion.
It's too bad humans can't learn things through an easier course.
But they don't. That's the way human nature is. And, it's like the question George Norrie asked me on Coast to Coast. He said, why can't people just get along?
Why can't nations
just get along? I mean, he's a rational, mild-mannered individual. And I said to him, look, George, the point is everybody's not like you and me. There is systematic evil in the world. There's a Satan in the world, just like there is a God, and he's working on people's minds constantly. In fact, every suicide that occurs happens when Satan gets into a person's mind and drives into it. And there have been several of these shootings, mass shootings lately, that talk about it. You know, satanic influence, seeing ghosts and visions and telling him to use a gun and to kill people before. And there's some real direction going on in these evil things that people need to be aware of.
There is, but drugs certainly make you more receptive to that.
Absolutely. And the reason that mood-altering drugs do that is because they suppress conscience.
Right.
So the good voice can't get through. And so people get driven to do things, and they keep going down that path. And that's why suicide is so prevalent when they start coming off those mood-altering drugs, because Satan gets back into the mind then and really takes back over again.
So the evil leaders lead to a lot of dead victims on both sides. I think the Russians and the Germans both ended up losing about 20 million of their own people, right, on each side.
That's right. Now, let's go back to the theme of globalism in World War II. Clear back as far as 1941 and 42, at the beginning of the war, the U.S. War Department had in their literature, they were still using the terms United Nations. The United Nations wasn't even formed till 1949.
Wow, that's interesting.
And yet, you see, the U.S. government and the British government were using in their communications United Nations troops and this and that, and they had already established this new world order before it was. And the charter was written by none other than Alger Hiss, the communist globalist, you know, who was deeply embedded within the Roosevelt administration. Mm-hmm. He eventually went to prison for perjury, for denying that he was a communist because of the testimony of Whitaker Chambers, who was a sincerely repentant communist who came out and fingered Alger Hiss as someone who actually had joined the Communist Party. Alger Hiss, Whitaker Chamber wrote the fabulous book Witness, and it's a great read to this day. I highly encourage it. But Alger Hiss was a really slick operator. Whitaker Chambers.
Chambers. Yeah, right. And it's called Witness?
Right.
Okay.
And so Eugene McCarthy, though rough around the edges, was right. The Truman and the Roosevelt administrations were full of communists. And the story of Major Racy Jordan of Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana, which was the jumping off point for all the aircraft taking lend-lease to the Soviet Union during World War II, is another story that's just fascinating, because he noticed about six heavy, big black trunks that were being shipped as diplomatic baggage. And it, you know, it was obviously too big for diplomatic baggage. And so he confiscated the trunks to the protest of the Russians, opened them up, and found that they were full of the plans for nuclear weapons that the U.S. was sending to Russia via Malmstrom Air Force Base that they couldn't steal yet from the Manhattan Project, you know, which was full of communists as well.
What year was that that happened?
That was 1945. So right at the end of the war, Racy Jordan confiscated these six black trunks. And within an hour, he got a call from the White House. The Russians had got back to the White House. And I forgot which communist agent it was, told him in the name of the White House that he was to close those trunks back up, give them back to the Soviets, and not ever say anything about it. Now, that wasn't all. In 1946, the United States shipped, actually it was very early in 1946, they shipped the first shipment of enriched uranium to the Russians so that they could explode their first nuclear weapon within a year after Hiroshima. The Russians didn't know how to enrich uranium. They had the plans, but they didn't have the technology to enrich uranium. So the U.S. shipped it to them. So the U.S. is directly responsible, those globalists within the Truman administration, responsible for making Russia a nuclear power. And of course, Russia then gave it to China and made China a nuclear power. And then in 1946 as well, George Catlett Marshall, a real globalist who was running Eisenhower and the Supreme Command, George Marshall cut off military aid to Chiang Kai-shek in China and brought Mao Zedong to power. And if you read the Wikipedia article on the fall of China, they'll say, well, the soldiers were all deserting Chiang Kai-shek because he was so unpopular. Well, the reason they were deserting him is because the U.S. had cut off military aid and had no ammunition. And the Russians were still feeding Mao with lots of guns, artillery, and ammunition. Prior to that point of the military aid cutoff, Mao was losing badly, and Chiang Kai-shek was winning.
And is that so, 1949, roughly?
Yes, right. And George Marshall went to Chiang Kai-shek and said, we want you to form a coalition government with the communists to end the civil war. Of course, Chiang didn't want to do that, knowing that the coalition with the communists always ends up in an overthrow. So he refused, and that's when Catlett Marshall cut off the military aid to them and allowed Mao Zedong to actually win the Civil War.
What was the the situation before that conflict occurred when Chiang Kai-shek, I guess, was in charge, right? That's something that's almost never talked about. What was the general society
remember
like?
The Chinese had finally won the war with Japan and driven the Japanese out with the help of American Air Power Group flying P-37s over the hump, you know, and C-47s to supply the Chinese army. And so Chiang Kai-shek was very popular because he had won the war against China. But the communists had always been a third rank building up in the face of Japanese dictatorship. They'd built up their communist forces and were supplied by the Russians. And that's where Mao got his power, and they continued to grow, but losing battles against Chiang Kai-shek after the Japanese had been driven out until this cutoff of military aid.
Right. What was Chiang Kai-shek's official position at that time?
He was Premier of China.
Premier, okay.
And, of course, before World War II, you had a lot of these warlords and battles, and that's one of the reasons why Japan was able to get in there and play havoc initially, was because they didn't have a very unified government, but they became unified under Chiang Kai-shek.
Okay. And that would have still been the government now, maybe, except for the cutoff of support, right?
That's right. And so Chiang Kai-shek fled to Taiwan, and that's how Taiwan got to be an independent country, and the U.S. did protect Taiwan from Chinese invasion.
Which was Formosa at the time.
That's right, which was Formosa. Now, we need to also discuss an economic issue here where it's taught universally in textbooks that the war caused the U.S. to come out of the Depression of
1930.
The Depression was actually made much worse by the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, which put U.S. tariffs on imported products and really crushed a lot of the, and there were retaliatory tariffs so that U.S. products couldn't be shipped now to Europe, etc. And so the 1933 or 31 or so Smoot-Hawley Tariff really plummeted further the U.S. stock market. And the Depression was caused, of course, by an excess of money printing by the Federal Reserve, which got this speculative fever going. And then they cut the money supply by two-thirds after the start of the Depression.
I didn't know it's two-thirds. That's
incredible. Exacerbated the Depression. And the U.S. did not actually come out of the Depression during World War II, even with full employment. Wages were still low. Everybody was employed. But you couldn't buy washing machines. You couldn't buy sewing machines because all of those U.S. goods were being shipped to the Soviet Union as lend-lease. Cars, trucks. What did they need washing machines for? Military aid. What did they need sewing machines for? It was just incredible. And so it wasn't actually until after World War II when all of the controls on price controls and production controls and factories were allowed to go back into private hands to start to produce consumer goods that the nation recovered economically. It wasn't until 1946 on through 50 where the boom started. It wasn't during World War II, even with full employment.
Well, right, but that boom was largely due to debt, right? I mean, it wasn't a totally legitimate boom. They went into massive debt and tax rates went up.
Debt during the war, but not after the war. In fact, federal spending plummeted as well because of the lack of the war machines. And so it really was an entrepreneur spirit of invention had really taken over. I mean, the Tucker automobile came out. All those inventions couldn't be produced during the war, happened after the war. And so it was just like a big vacuum of entrepreneurial spirit sucking up every bit of savings. And the savings rate came from the salaries of people who worked in the war factories. They were saving.
Right.
And so it wasn't an artificial boom. It was a real boom, a pent-up demand and entrepreneurial spirit.
But taxes and fiat money greatly both increased during that time, right?
Well, it really wasn't a heavy increase during that time. You know, the Congress had gone back to more of a sound money. They were still on, you know, the Bretton Woods Agreement had come into being. They were still on a gold standard, so that was restricting any expansion of the money supply.
And why were all the washing machines sent to the Soviet Union?
Boy, your guess is as good as mine. Just a bunch of pro-communist people probably in the State Department trying to buy favor with Stalin and give him a leg up over Americans. I mean, there's no military reason for it. Why would the women need washing machines or sewing machines other than, you know, to make uniforms? But this was after the war as well, until this Lend-Lease got shut down. But tremendous amount of evil went on in the world due to Lend-Lease.
Okay. And that was also the time when the United Nations was getting started too, right?
That's right.
45 or so.
That's right. Well, the United Nations was, of course, started in it was being used, even though it wasn't officially, Alger Hiss didn't write, and it wasn't started until right after the war, officially as an organization.
Right, right.
Now, let's talk about the overall globalist objective in terms of war. Now, remember, World War I failed in giving them a globalist government, the League of Nations, but it did eliminate Russia and Germany as monarchies that could be dealt with. The Weimar Republic suffered, and they created the atmosphere for World War II. They guaranteed it by the reparations in Versailles. Now, after World War II, they created the seeds of conflict. Even though the Charter of the United Nations stated that you cannot have tyrannical governments in there, they invited Russia to join and have a seat on the Security Council. But the United Nations had no power. It had no taxing power. It had a peacekeeping force eventually, but real no military power. And so World War II had not achieved the globalist objective of getting us into a rigorous, militarized, taxing, all-controlling world government. That will take a third world war. And so as we leave World War II, most of the draconian war powers were taken down. Sovereignty was returned to all the nations. The United Nations became kind of an advisory organization filled with a bunch of socialists, which used American money, you know, to promote these things around the world and do a lot of damage, still does a lot of damage. I'm sorry that Trump has not gone through with his promise, you know, to get us out of the United Nations, but that would be very, very difficult because you never see how powerful the globalists are until you start to dismantle one of their international organizations.
Well, and what would come out on the media would be quite interesting as well, that we've got somebody going completely crazy and the government has to be dealt with.
That's right. Now, so the Cold War begins, and the Cold War was marked by appeasement of the Soviet Union. They had Patton killed. I believe he was murdered in the hospital bed after he had survived the crash. He was murdered there because he was a very popular general, and he was trying to drum up support for driving the Soviet Union out of Eastern Europe. And globalism would have had a very different turn had Patton lived. There's also the myth about the Marshall Fund and how it built Europe. Now, it did end up building Europe, and it was a massive welfare system internationally to rebuild Europe. But, you know, economically, you have to go to Henry Hazlitt's broken glass syndrome. You know, if war is good to destroy everything and then rebuild, then why doesn't everybody break their windows? What benefit would there be to everyone going out and breaking your windows? Would everyone be better off if you all broke your windows and had to go to the store to buy them? Of course not.
Well, plus there's the little detail that all that aid to rebuild Europe was completely unconstitutional, right?
It was.
There's no basis for that.
That's right. Legal. And so, you know, it created a lot of debt. You know, the world has come out of it, or has the appearance of coming out of it, because of fiat money, mm-hmm. Being able to just print more and more money. You know, and that works initially until inflation hits, and that's what it's hit in almost every socialist country. Even Norway, with its oil revenues, had to cut back on the amount of welfare. Sweden had to cut back because it just was bankrupting the country. Britain had its Thatcher revolution because of the but socialism is coming back again, as we know in the news, because once again this benefit corrupted lure of saying, you know, you just everyone deserves a living wage, everyone deserves money, and we ought to just, you know, and it's incredible to think about how you pay for that. I mean, $93 trillion for Medicaid for all, but that's getting into current events. But it's important to realize that through the Cold War period, we placated the Soviet Union, we played footsie with them, and if it weren't for the Bay of Pigs thing, that's when Russia really showed its hand and Kennedy had to get involved. We'll take that on the next episode, the assassination of President Kennedy, what he was going to do to the CIA after the Bay of Pigs was canceled while he slept. And a lot of interesting conspiratorial things that happened, and how President Eisenhower finally woke up a little bit, at least to the military-industrial complex toward the end of his day. But I think he was guilty most of his life for what he did under globalism in World War II.
Sounds right. Well, good stopping point. And It's really an incredible, exciting drama that's unfolding. And these are the earlier stages. We're like listening to the prologue of where we are now. Yeah. But we're not out of the movie yet. It's really in an intense part now. So going to episode 3 as soon as we get a chance to come back together shortly.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Yeah, thank you. And we'll talk to you soon. Okay, so there goes Joel Skousen. That was a pretty heavy-duty episode, I think. a lot of things he brought up that I obviously didn't know. And I think, though, that my intuition was correct before we started this series, don't you guys, that Joel's rare teacher, who's not going down a checklist like the modern so-called educators are, that say this, say this, say this, use this book, and make sure everybody ends up believing such and such. This is a guy that has done some real deep study and has the experience to go with it. So I think we're super fortunate to get somebody of his caliber to be willing to talk to us. And I really appreciate that, Joel. Thank you. A lot of it's pretty heavy duty stuff and not what's necessarily politically correct and acceptable, but what we're interested in is whatever's true, right? Not being against anybody or, you know, making the theme to have all this conflict. We just want to find out what really happened. And in order to understand what's really going on in the present, it really helps to, you know history so that you don't necessarily absolutely have to repeat it. And so I put great value on people like Joel with the experience in it. It doesn't mean that it's telling you to agree with everything he says, because that's not the right spirit of learning, but it means you're kind of inspired by the things that he brings up. You can check them out. He gave us two books to read in this episode. One of them was Whitaker Chambers, the one called Witness. I have not read that book, but he says it's really good. And the other one, Churchill's War by David Urban. I haven't read that one either, but I'll probably try to read both of them because I'm really voracious for wanting to absorb history from all different points of view and find out what was really going on. But the purpose of this whole thing, to me, I know Joel feels like all we can do is, you know, survive the coming World War III, but he may be right. I'd just like to see if there's a way we can avoid it, you know, and make things turn around and be better in the world. That would be great. I guess we won't know till it's all over what was possible, but just to be the best people to input positive energy and wisdom into this whole completely insane and good versus evil drama that we're in the middle of. Whatever we can do positively would be good. So hope you enjoyed it. Hope you got a lot out of it. Remember that Joel is the author of books that are still available on Amazon. The Secure Home, I think, is one of them, and Strategic Relocation, which I've read, is the other one that's excellent. And his newsletter is World Affairs Brief, and he's put out this offer, which I assume is still good. You write to the editor at, or not the editor, but just editor at worldaffairsbrief.com and ask for a free sample issue. It doesn't cost anything, and you can see what he writes about in his newsletter. It's very well done, very interesting, very well documented, the one that I saw. And you might like to look into that. Remember that we have a new page on Subscribestar for anybody that would like to support us. We're not obviously not pushing products or anything. I want to keep the energy really clear and open on this whole project, this broadcast. So if you have the means and you want to support us, there's various ways to do that. You can go to subscribestar.com/LostArtsRadio, and $1 a month, or if you're, as I've said before, a friendly billionaire and you appreciate what we're doing, and especially the school that we want to build, donate to us on a one-time or a recurring basis. That would be appreciated. Another way is to get involved in Planetary Healing Club, where we talk about some of the deeper issues that we cannot put on public platforms because they'll be blocked and censored completely right away. We're already being shadow banned and censored to a great degree, but it would become complete. So the things that we'd like to talk about, including the research that I've been involved in over the last five decades or more, we can do that in interactive, live, uncensored basis in Planetary Healing Club. And you can get to that through the access point at planetaryhealingclub.com, and it involves information that you can use to transform your own life if you'd like to put in the work to do that. It's a good place to start with everything, I think. Something we're working on live every week and that could have global implications on a really good level. The other thing is that people have asked about the project to build the school that has been in the works for a long time and is just now being publicly discussed. That some of the details on one configuration of it are available at lostartsresearchinstitute.org. And if you go there and read about it, there's a one possible business plan is there for the school. It's a big project, and we need to find funding for that too. If you're interested in knowing more about that, write to me at richard@lostartsradio.com, and I'll be happy to read your letter and answer you as soon as time allows. I think that's most of what we're talking about. Remember too that we're now on brighteon.com, brighteon.com, and our channel is brighteon.com/channel/Lost Arts Radio. We can put things up there that we can't easily post on some of the other public platforms. And you want to support brighteon.com because it's a great service that's being put up by our friend Mike, whose last name I can't mention without getting banned ourselves right away, but you probably know who I'm talking about, doing great service for the world. And all of us need to help each other and stay in touch. And any comments or questions or suggestions for shows, anything like that that you want to share, I'll read all the emails, richard@lostartsradio.com. I think that's about it. And keep watching the Sunday shows. We're going to have lots of inspiring people that are real educators, and will share with you what they're doing. It might give you ideas that you can use. So to better your own situation in your own life, and ways to make a living that doing things that you love instead of staying at a job that you don't relate to at all. I'm really looking for ways that we can more use our time in ways that we care about. So hopefully that's useful to you. And thanks for the time, and we'll look forward to seeing you shortly on the same show. Talk to you soon.
Introducing Lost Arts Radio on Subscribestar.com. Just go to Subscribestar.com/Lost Arts Radio to find our rewards program, offering 10 different giving levels starting at just $5 a month. We offer incredible value for any rewards level, from extra monthly interview videos not available publicly to subscription-based Planetary Healing Club videos once, twice, or three times a month, to private counseling sessions with Lost Arts Radio host Richard Sacks, to tech help with me, Doug Diamond. We even have one option where you can be the star on Lost Arts Radio as our guest on a specially produced show just for you. We conduct an interview with you and broadcast it to our growing network and listenership. Our subscribe star levels are one of a kind and offer great rewards for any budget. Please help support Lost Arts Radio. We can't do it without you. With increasing censorship on many of our channels, we really need your support today to keep doing what we're doing. As Richard says, we're not even at survival level yet. Lost Arts Radio has three weekly shows. Lost Arts Radio Live each Saturday night at 7:30 Eastern, 4:30 Pacific, which is a live stream currently on multiple platforms in case we get banned from some of the larger ones. Right now, we're on two YouTube channels, Facebook Live, Periscope, which is Twitter, Twitch, and DLive. You can access these broadcasts by going to www.lostartsradio.com/live for all the links to those channels. The Planetary Healing Club meets right after Lost Arts Radio Live at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific on Saturday nights. And our Sunday show with guests airs at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific on Sunday nights on our Blog Talk Radio channel, our YouTube channels, Facebook pages, and on Brighteon. Be sure to sign up for our free email list just in case we do get banned on big tech's platforms. It's just a matter of time, really. They don't like the stuff we talk about, and they do not want the truth out there. In fact, they have already attacked us numerous times. Join our free email list so we can let you know where we are and how to access our shows. The sign-up button is right on the top right on most pages of our website. The best starting point for all things Lost Arts Radio is our main site, lostartsradio.com, where you can find the hottest new selection videos that we curate just for you. Those are on the homepage and added to daily as well as articles and breaking news about information you really need to know. Our show archives, the 10 most recent shows, are right on our homepage, as well as our Blog Talk Radio page at blogtalkradio.com/lostartsradio, or just click the All Things Radio Show tab right on our website. We're in the podcast directory on iTunes, and all of our shows except the banned ones are on our YouTube channels at Lost Arts Radio and at Diamond Disc. Our Brighteon page is really taking off, and we often have editors' picks videos right on their homepage. Visit brighteon.com/channel/lostartsradio. On our site, you can also access our free listener forum as well as sign up for the Planetary Healing Club, which is just $25 a month, where you get private access to a one-on-one interaction with host Richard Sacks and myself and the other club members who participate live. More info can be found at planetaryhealingclub.com. We're providing solutions in there to make the world a better place. Come join us. Stay tuned, because up next, you'll get to hear a really great song by an independent artist that we're doing our best to support. Go to lostartsradio.com/music for the full list of all the great songs and bands that we spin on our audio-only podcast shows. If you're in a band and want to submit a song for consideration for airplay on Lost Arts Radio, visit my website at diamonddiscaudio.com for more information about the music placement, mastering, and mixing work that I do. Thanks again for listening to and supporting Lost Arts Radio. We love having you as part of our family to learn, experience, and grow with.
Living in America used to be a dream for so many people far away and unseen, with their big cars, movie stars. Living in America, all hail to the red, white, and blue. Living in America wasn't a dream. In this land, they tell you to reach anything you want, and everything is possible, just believe that you can. We're God's chosen children, living in America with that long house and my picket fences. Living in America was a dream. Now they believe that their Savior has come to deliver all their people back to the kingdom. Better not try to stop us all. What it takes to change the world again. Country follows us everywhere, 'cause they've lost their voice, they've lost their way, and feel safe in our shadow. Now it's all gone, the glory day.